This time, I would like to introduce our first speaker, and that will be Bill P.
I'm an addict, and I'm Bill. And at first I wondered if there wasn't some message in it for me being asked to do this. Leadership by example. When I came here, I was broken. I was burnt. I was an empty shell of a man. I had nothing, no place left to go. I had tried everything. I had tried everything. I played those games everybody else did. I didn't go here. I didn't go there. I didn't take my money. Didn't take my checks. My disease always went with me. You know? And everywhere I went, whether I chose to or not, I was an example. You know, when I was out there doing what I was doing, when I was living my other life, when I was deep in my disease, I was invisible. You know, people could see through me. There wasn't anything there. I was unable to live in society's conscience. I was unable to live within society's conscience. I continued to do those things that kept me bruised and broken inside. I was real glad to hear we didn't disrespect the readings, and when it said sick, people chant, "Oh, sick." You know, all those years, all the things that we did caused each and every one of us a great deal of harm and a great deal of pain. You know, we all come in here wounded. I got here and I was done. I was done. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I didn't want one more. I didn't want any more. I was done using. One of the things that happened when I came around is that it's hard to describe the feeling, but it was almost that childlike joy of being able to be accepted. And it was because of, not in spite of, what I had lived and who I had become when I went to what became my first home group. And I was able to sweep the floors and empty the ashtrays and actually participate. You know, and I had no idea. I had no idea. But I was an example. I was an example. Wherever I go and whatever I do, I'm an example. You know, when I thought about this, and it's, well, like, am I supposed to do these things because I'm supposed to be an example to somebody? You know? I know that when I came here, it's sort of like, you know, when you take the pot of the hash out of the Alice B. Toklas brownie, and it's got little chocolate chips in it, it's got nuts in it, and it's got, you know, it's got the hash in it, and you take the hash out, what you're left is still with a brownie with nuts in it. And so, like, when I got here, I was like a flaming codependent. You know, I was still used to using people, places, and things to make me feel whole, try to make me feel like a man, you know, because I was so much less than. I didn't know how to live. Well, slowly but surely, because I was so broken and I was so lost, I chose to follow direction. I learned a little bit about letting go. I learned a little bit about surrender. I was able to get honest with myself. And yeah, cash register honesty is important. You know, but it's also about honesty about how I feel. Being willing to make myself vulnerable. You know, it's great when we hear people share in meetings about how wonderful Narcotics Anonymous is, and I start to hear this band playing and the drum beating in the background, and that's wonderful. But we're all here because we know it works, you know. And an example is for me to be able to stand up here and let you know, not just like that, well, that I was feeling a little bit uncomfortable. I was glad to see there was only a few people here, and now the room is like a lot more full than it was in the beginning. But one of the things that I learned that my sponsor gave me was that instead of being afraid, you're all here to hear a message, you know, and I can use that energy. I can use that energy to share about my experience. I didn't know how to live. You showed me how to live. You know, leading by example, I keep thinking about doing this or like some responsibility. And my responsibility is to me in my recovery, in this new life. In the second step, I was given direction to write about the man that I wanted to be. I had no idea what that was. I had some kind of image, and I was about flashy stuff, things on the exterior, you know, people, places, and things. And so by the time I got to the second step, I'd been exposed to some principles, you know, hope, belief, trust came back to me from seeking help, going to meetings. There's no greater healing power than in a meeting. You know, courage and confidence, commitment, able to hold a commitment, sharing and caring, all these things came to me from seeking help. I began to have some principles in place of the cesspool of a belief system that I came in here with. Then I was asked to write about what kind of man I wanted to be. So I had something to hold on to, not just where I came from. You know, it's not enough to know what it isn't. I need to have some kind of direction. I need to have a path. So I got to write about what kind of man I wanted to be. In the third step, turning my will and my life over to the God of my understanding became real elusive to me. You know, I didn't know what that was. I know my will and my life is about my thoughts and my actions. You know, it comes to be about how I live. This is a way of life. You know, what I began to get a glimpse of is that I need to be an example to me. I'm tired of hurting myself in recovery. I'm tired of bruising Bill. I'm tired of living against my ethics. I'm tired of living outside my morals. I don't like that. I don't like being short and sharp or curt to somebody because, like, I'm judging them in some way. We come around here and, you know, I suffered through this for a long time. Some of the lessons I had to learn took a little bit longer than I thought I saw other people being able to grab a hold of some of these things. And I learned a little bit. I learned a little bit about me, and all of a sudden I started doing this. You know, when I was judging you for either what you said or what you didn't do, or, you know, and there was like this pegboard up on the wall. I'd put you over here and I'd put you over there because of the way you're dressed or how you talk or what you share about. And what the disease had me doing was separating me from you. Mm-hmm. And what I did in recovery, I became a peripheral member. One of those members that had a home group, but I didn't have a commitment in it. I didn't go to other meetings. I didn't share. So I went to one meeting a week. Let's see. If I missed a meeting, that means one meeting in every 2 weeks. I don't know about all of you, but if anybody's ever tried that before, and I bet you at least one person in here has, that gets real painful, man. It gets real painful, and it becomes insane. I was not being an example. You know, the second tradition talks about us actually having leaders. Our leaders are but trusted servants. What's a trusted servant? It used to be my mind went to like some kind of service structure thing. To me now, what's a trusted servant? Who's the person I want to be a leader for me? An example. Leading by example. It's the kind of person that at the end of a meeting, if there's somebody that had raised their hand because they were new, and you know, you can tell the difference. You can pretty well tell the difference because if it's somebody that's just there for their first meeting, or they've been to other meetings, it's their first time at that particular meeting, you know. After a meeting, they'll go up and talk to them, you know. They have a Narcotics Anonymous sponsor that has a Narcotics Anonymous sponsor. They work the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. You know, I used to talk about the 12 and the and like they're separate or something, and they're not. It's like if you have a pair of gloves, you have to have both of them. And what our program is about the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. Don't make a mistake and think like they're different or the traditions are and or, but it's part of. You know, somebody that has a home group and they're committed to it and they have a commitment in it. They sponsor people. You know, these are the leaders for me. These are the examples that I want to be led by in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, some of us still do all kinds of things in here, and that's okay. I know that we're all on the same. It's not to judge, but there's a difference between judging and observing. It's important for me to be able to judge, because when I observe, again, I separate myself. I separate myself. I make myself different, and that's my ego wanting me to be, telling me I'm superior, you know. But there's a lot of people in here that do stuff like, I see guys slinging their dicks around like a frisbee. You can't recover. You cannot recover through your zipper. It doesn't work. You know, it's about something on the outside. Change how I feel in some way. You know, you just can't do it. It doesn't work. You can only do that for so long, and you're going to become in so much pain that you're either going to use or you're going to change. People gamble and do all sorts of things. Buy things. I went through that. Man, I bought stuff beyond my means intentionally, trying to make myself feel better. Using. That's what I did when I was using. Change how I felt. Either escape or get a feeling or something. You know, and those aren't the kind of examples that I want leading me. That's observation, man. It doesn't make them bad. It doesn't make them wrong. It's just not somebody or something that I want to do. I've been there and it doesn't work. So, you know, this is a God-centered program, and if that pisses somebody off in here, or like you've got a serious God block and the red brick wall just went up because you heard the G word, please keep coming back. Keep coming back. This is a God-centered program, and it's based on the practice of principle, relationship with God. The 11th step talks about conscious contact. Now, that doesn't mean not until I get to the 11th step do I have conscious contact. We begin to work on that from the very beginning. You know, that block. And I've heard people say, like, my spirit is diseased. My spirit gives me bad information. My spirit or my soul is a messenger of God and will never, ever steer me wrong. Never, ever. You know, and when I came around, it was like that path was blocked by all that encrusted shit I built up. The substance was denial, and I built it with justification and rationalization to continue to do all those things that I did. When I was using and when I came in here too. All that stuff. It's just time. It's about chip, chip, tink, tink, tink. It's like making a piece of sculpture. You know, I had to keep coming back. I had to keep practicing. You know, and when I hurt myself, I had to find a place, call my sponsor, oh, well, you know, and it's like, I'm real grateful for the men in my life, because what they did is they directed me to the steps of tradition that applied to and about the principle that I need to practice in my life. You know, I need to have guidance. I need to have direction, and I need to be willing to seek that. You know, I speak to a minimum of 3 to 4 people a day in recovery. This is what I was taught to do. I have 16 years, and that's not to brag, but there's a message in this. I go to 5 meetings a week. I talk to at least 3 to 4 people a day, and I have 16 years. Do you see the relationship? If you think you are different, you are welcome to that. If you think you are unique and you don't have to do that, maybe you don't. Because you know what? We can do absolutely anything in here that we choose as long as we can stand the pain. But there's a way that's been proven to work. And it's leadership by example that I have become able to recognize, and perhaps in some small way, because of the insanity and pain that I generated for myself in recovery, am now able to live in some small way. You know, in turning my will and my life over, I had to understand what. What was that? And I hear something, well, I don't need to know what it is, I just need to know what it's not. I'm sorry, but I need a path. Yes. I need a path. What is the nature of the God of my understanding? Another wonderful exercise I was given, the nature of the God of my understanding. My God is not judgmental. My God did not give me choice to punish me for using it. My God loves me unconditional. My God is caring. My God is compassionate. My God is nurturing. These are things that I can do. You know, most difficult, though, with people that are closest to me. I have a 15-year-old son, hormones with feet. I can tell when he's not telling the truth because his lips are moving. How do I deal with this? How do I deal with this? You know, it's not easy. And it's like about being consistent. It's about being persistent. It's not about being short, sharp, curt, pissed off, or angry. How am I helping him? What kind of example am I setting for my son when I try to shout him down because I think he's doing something wrong? Man, he's trying to find out who in the hell he is. He's doing the same thing I am. I'm still trying to figure out who I am. You know, that's what he's trying to do, is figure out who he is. You know, so I got to keep coming back, and I just got to keep doing these things, and I got to practice. Because I don't like it when I live outside of my ethics and my morals. And this is a God-centered program. And how do I know that? Well, I mean, how do I follow that? What do? I need to listen. I need to be able to listen. To truly have choice, I have to have discernment. Enlightenment comes from listening. That very first, one of the first things about surrender was, take that deep breath, Bill. And slow down. Because my mind has everything figured out and is way out here in front of me. And I'm left trying to catch up and I miss shit. You know? And most of all, that noise between my ears. When I first began to work the second step, what I heard was this committee. And I said, oh my God, that was never there before. It was leading me through my entire life. It was always there. This is the disease. Tell me, all coming from all different directions, tell me to do all this dysfunctional shit that's in opposition to who I really want to be. To who I really want to be. I also began to hear a little voice of reason. A little voice of reason. At first it was quiet. It was almost indiscernible. And it was like in these little breaks in this noise. It's because of the practice of principle. Putting myself in places where I can be healed. You know, sharing about making myself vulnerable in front of you. Letting you know what my pains are and my fears are. It's about a spiritual awakening. It's a spiritual awakening. And the result is the practice of these things that's told for me to do, the steps and the traditions, helps the God of my understanding become alive to me. And I used to think I'd pray to God, like I'd call God to me. One of the things I hear that's the same with anybody, regardless of the religion that you practice, if you have one. Whatever your belief is that everybody says the same thing. God dwells in here. God's inside. So who am I to think that I call God to me? I call myself to God. I'm the one with the disease of addiction. I'm the one that separates with my thoughts, belief, my words, and my actions, myself from that little voice of reason, that message, enlightenment, direction, the guidance that I seek. things I need to do. Things I need to do for Bill. So I don't bruise or hurt me one more time. Don't use, if it was that simple, you know, all anybody could white knuckle it and stay clean. But, you know, don't use. You go to meetings, right? We go to meetings. What else do we do? Yeah, we work the steps. We have a sponsor. We get a home group. We have a commitment in that home group. And we go to meetings, you know, have an understanding and work the traditions. And we go to meetings, you know, and we go to meetings. And we do all these things, you know. And before you know it, men were asking me to sponsor them. Men were honoring me with that responsibility, asking me to sponsor them, you know. And I don't believe it's because of who I had become in spite of me. This is who I was always meant to be. I don't believe that we are clean against all odds. This is choice. This is about choice. We all know that if everybody that had this problem, had disease of addiction, needed to be at a meeting, all the stadiums in the country would be filled at one time. There's no secret about that. I was given a gift, a little glimpse. I was given a gift. And something inside, I felt enough to grab a hold of and didn't let go. You know, the God of my understanding talks to me. And I'm not afraid to say that today. The God of my understanding communicates with me. Well, wait a minute, 11th step, that's no secret. It says conscious contact. Anybody ever wake up with like this wonderful message or some kind of solution or some answer to something? Anybody ever experience that? Wake up with something, you don't know where it came from. Where were you while you were asleep? You know, but this is 11th step is about conscious contact. That's about through the day. That's about through the day. You know, and I have to learn to put a break on this, on the disease. I have to learn to put a break on it to stop that, like, whirling pile of shit that's still left in there so I can hear. Meditation is so important. When I went on the fifth step, my sponsor gave me this sheet of paper. Him and his sponsor both signed, and it said, I'm supposed to start to write a daily inventory, and I'm supposed to meditate. Anything we do that's new isn't going to be just like we're going to get everything out of it the first time we do it. It's about practice. It's about practice. It's about practice. There is no perfection. There is no perfection. You know, people, we're all about instant gratification. We wind up in a program we need to participate in for the rest of our life to save our life. Never comes to fruition. The attraction of the fruition, or bringing this to reality, is about living it. It's about the journey. This is where the joy is. This is where the joy is. And so, you know, meditation allows me to practice, to work that muscle, to build up that, to be able to shut this down, quiet my mind. Because I could be in the middle of the day and somebody does something that's just plain pisses me off really bad and I want to go off, you know. And I need to be able to be conscious of what's going on up there, awareness, right, to be able to put the brakes on, you know. Humility comes to be real important to me, and I used to think it was about, like, you know, being real humble. I used to think it was about coming into meetings quietly and sitting down. You know, maybe they're part of it. About being respectful when somebody's sharing. Here's the tough part. Even when I think what they're sharing is bullshit. You know, but humility today is about knowing who I am and acting accordingly.
Thank you.
Acting accordingly. You know, and all these things are part of who I am today, you know, and I have all of you to thank. I have all of Narcotics Anonymous to thank. Because without you, there is no me. The dreams that I had lost that have been awakened in my life, and I have been the things that I have been allowed to live and participate in that bring me joy and pleasure wouldn't be there if it wasn't for the God of my understanding, the program of Narcotics Anonymous, and all of you. Thanks for asking me to share.
Okay, now I would like to introduce our second speaker, Alvin. I don't know your last name. Alvin E.
I'm Alvin. I'm an addict.
Hey, Alvin.
It's only by God's grace that I stand here clean. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful weekend. I'd like to thank the CPRNA 18 Programming Committee for asking me to share my experience, Strength and Hope. And I've got a lot out of all the workshops that I've been to. And but I tell you, Frisbee Dick is the probably the biggest and most important thing I've got out of this. I want to go home and tell my wife when I'm on the road home and call her. She say, "Well, honey, how was the convention?" I'm going to say, "Frisbee Dick." And she'll do what she's prone to do, just kind of hang up the phone and just say, "God, why me? Why did he have to be my husband?" Yeah, I'm a little nervous, so why don't we do this? Kind of get up and stretch, get a breath of fresh air, kind of hug each other. Come on. Tell the person next to you when you hug them, welcome, and keep coming back. Come on. Come on. I know some of you don't like that. I know. It's okay. It's okay.
This is
wonderful.
Yeah.
You can sit for 30 minutes. You know, get some blood circulating. Huh. Okay, okay.
Now you started something.
It's okay, it's okay.
Give your time.
Yeah, kind of like, you know, that initial, like everybody's waiting for you to say something that's, you know, it's going to change their life. You know, and you're just trying to make sure you don't fart.
Don't fog up.
Yeah. Paige, sit down, Albert. More powerful than words, just for today, September the 10th, we learned that a simple, loving hug can make all the difference in the world.
Yes, it can.
You know, and I need that today. It's been a real emotional day for me. Between my praying and asking God to take my will in my life and guide me in my recovery. And when I have to do a workshop, man, you know, a lot of times I get so far up in this cranium here that I need a simple way, okay, to kind of help me stay out of the way, you know. So what I do is I just say a soft, simple prayer throughout the day, you know, that kind of helps me get to this point. And it started out, man, not only have I been praying, thank you, brother, you know, it's been an emotional day. I've been crying. This morning, we distributed the ashes of one of my sponsees out on the beach 8 o'clock this morning, and he was, what, 33 years old, you know, died of pneumonia a couple of months ago. It's been about a month and a half now. So that's what we had to do, and once that started, that kind of opened up, ooh, I can't see, the floodgates, you know, in terms of that, because back in September, I took the ashes of my son and spread those out in Rock Creek Park, and he was 21 years old. You know, and it's been like that, really emotional to be here, because when I was here last April, my son was alive, Bruce was alive. You know, one of my best friends was pregnant, and not by me. but by her husband, and and she had a stillborn, so that's kind of like, you know, all those emotions started coming back, man. And one of the things I recognized that, you know, in Narcotics Anonymous, you guys provide me with the shelter from the storm. So that any time that I'm going through something, you know, you'll be here to support me and to love me and to hug me and to kind of get me back in shape and back in form, you know, so that I can kind of keep going on, man, you know. And for the last 6 or 7, 8 months, man, that I've, my recovery, man, you guys have been an example of the power that can carry me through whatever you're going through. You know what I'm saying? The members of Narcotics Anonymous will be there for you, man. You know, it might not be your turn yet. You know what I mean? You might not have never lost a job or never lost a family member or, you know, never had an experience, man, other than the fact that, you know, your transmission fell out, man. But I just believe the normal order of life, you know, we have a chapter that talks about more will be revealed. It talks about lost divorce and loss of jobs and stuff like that, man. There'll come a time, man, where we will need not only a God of your understanding, but the people in these rooms, man, to kind of keep you up, man, and keep you from falling down. A third tradition, and it works out when it talks about, you know, identification, you know, that many addicts, and especially the new addict that comes in, needs to identify, you know, not just only with, you know, how our stories are now, but how it was. So I'm going to kind of briefly identify. When I got here, you know, all this didn't matter. You know, I was the kind of guy that was very selfish and very self-centered. You know, I had a lot of hatred on the one hand and fear and resentment and anger, you know, at no particular person, just had it. You know, I remember God, Mark L. always talks about if everybody in the world that he was angry with was dead, he'd still be angry. You know, and that's the kind of guy, you know, I was, man. Kind of guy, man, that, you know, even as a young boy, man, I used to fight my teachers, you know, fight all in the neighborhood. I know people can't hardly believe that now. Some of my friends, they say, no, you wasn't that kind of guy. Yes, I was. I was that kind of guy, man, filled with that kind of rage, you know. You know, and still today I don't exactly know where it came from, you know, and for me to recover, it's not important. You know, it's not important. And the only thing that's important, man, is to recognize that I have a disease, you know, from which there is no known cure. You know, and somewhere along the line, man, I remember having just one. You know, I was the kind of guy, man, that never felt good about myself. You know, I wasn't short enough. I didn't talk fast enough. I didn't dance good enough. I didn't dress well enough. But once I got one in me, all those things just seemed to disappear. You know, I just seemed to be able to fit in anywhere and everywhere, you know. And I remember, man, how my using started to progress. And I remember it was just, you know, I was the kind of guy who would just use on the weekends. You know, and I'd have the money kind of separated. You know, this was the bill money. This was the transportation money. This was the get-out money. Okay, and then, you know, it would just be Friday and Saturday. And then, you know, I'd add on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You know, and what eventually happened, man, is like, you know, I started using, you know, each and every day. And the power for the bill money got smaller, and the power for the using money got, you know, got larger. And at the end, when at the end of the road, man, you know, I was living to use and using to live. You know, everything I tried to stop, you know, and I tried many things. I tried medicine, religion, and psychiatry, you know, and I literally told myself it just wasn't sufficient. Didn't say it couldn't work. It just wasn't sufficient, you know. It couldn't help me stay stopped. You know, I tried all those things. And at the bitter end, man, I realized, man, that I had a problem. I realized I had a problem long before I stopped, you know. But I didn't know what I was dealing with. I thought if something was wrong with me, how could all these other people use and get high and have no problem with their life? Well, I see now that y'all, you know, did have a problem. At the time, I believed that I was alone, you know, and that, you know, only, you know, that I was the only sucker in the world, you know. You know, I come from an era of John Wayne, Shaft, and James Bond, you know, and you just don't surrender, man, when you're watching them kind of movies. You just don't give up, man, you know, and so, you know, it was hard for me to acknowledge that, you know, that I had a problem, and that for me to win, that I had to surrender, you know. And as a result of that, man, you know, I took some painful ass whoopings, you know, unnecessarily. You know, at the end, man, I get paid on Friday nights. You know, and all I had on Saturday morning was the bus transfer from Friday night. You know, I get out, man, and I tell myself, well, I just put my money, you know, in different pockets. You know what I'm saying? I'd have four pockets, and I said, well, this, the front pockets would be the using money, and the back pockets would be the money I'd take home. You know, at the end of the night, I'd be taking off my shoes, searching for money in the socks. No, I didn't put none in. The crazy thing about my using, man, is that, you know, look, you know, I use the kind of drugs, man, that, you know, you'd get high in the house and you'd be looking, you know, for pebbles on the street three blocks away. I dropped one over there, didn't I? At the end, man, it'd be like 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, man. All the money be gone. All the dope be gone. And, you know, once the money and the dope are gone, all the women are gone. Okay. And, you know, who knows what? And you're just there, you know, by yourself, you know, with those feelings, man, trying to figure out, man, what is wrong with me, you know. My last day of using, man, and, you know, there's a, you know, just a, there's a correlation between my last day of using it and what I believe is probably my, you know, a spiritual awakening of sorts. It was on Q Street in Northwest D.C. by DuPont Circle. And I've been out hustling all day, and I know this is God's grace, man. I know because I didn't get high that day. I didn't get any money. I was out hanging out with a guy who was, you know, a really good pickpocket. I mean, this guy was really sharp. But he hadn't made any money. And then he realized about 7 o'clock that the reason he hadn't made any money because he was hanging with me. So he knew how to get money. He just had this dead weight, right? So he told me, he said, man, look, you know, look, I'm going on my way, man. So you know, I figured I'd resort to, you know, to my hustle, using women. And I saw this woman, and I wanted to snatch her purse, you know. So, but I was scared and I was nervous. And when I snatched the purse, the strap broke and it hit the ground. And she screamed and ran one way, and I screamed and ran the other way. And the purse just laid there. The story's still funny. And I ran, and I ran for all of a half a block, you know, tired and busted and disgusted, man. And I said the dope fiend prayer, you know, the foxhole prayer, God help me. You know, and for the first time in years, you know, I said a prayer, you know, in years, you know, I came in here, you know, the only prayer I knew when I came in here for real was, now lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord the soul to keep. I was 33 years old, man. That's the only prayer I knew, the prayer of a child. And I was reduced to a child, you know, through my own disease. You know, an addict who was my brother, you know, and God bless him. You know, he 12-stepped me into this program. And, you know, and if you have family out there, you know, and siblings, and you know, you think they can't get here. If you stay here, they stand a chance of getting here. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm a living example of that. And my journey in this program, man, it started to accelerate. You know, I went to a treatment facility, and that's not an endorsement. It's just a part of my story. Because, you know, I've been, my clean date is May 9th, 1986. I'll be celebrating 18 years at my home group, May 14th, Recovery Alley in Washington, D.C. And like I said, this is not an endorsement of treatment facilities. I know there are people here, you know, who have come here, man, straight off the street. So if you're here, stay here. Mm-hmm. Just stay here. I started going to meetings, man, and I started running into people, man, who were setting the example for me even back then. You know, we didn't have a lot of meetings in the Washington area. We had only one area. We had only one area. We had only one area. I'm going to let that go now. In the Washington, D.C. area. You know, for whatever reason, it's a God-gifted program. For whatever reason, now we have three areas in Washington, D.C. And I started going to meetings, man. I started going to meetings. And when I didn't feel good about what was going on with me, you know, I went to meetings. You know, they told me that meeting makers make it in Narcotics Anonymous. And, you know, and that's what I wanted to do. We didn't have a lot of service positions in Narcotics Anonymous in there. You know, we didn't have a lot of meetings, didn't have a lot of service positions. So as a result, you know, getting a service position was a pretty big thing. Yeah, yeah, it really was. So what you would do, you'd have, you kind of, you know, if you wanted a service position in a group or a committee, you'd, you know, you'd bring six or seven of your friends in like ringers, doing the group conscious. Yeah. That's bringing a loving God in there now. Bring eight or nine of your friends, and all of them would vote for you. And you'd get the trusted servant position. And and other people, what we would do after, we'd take them out to eat so that, you know, they could kind of help them deal with their feelings. And I understand today that that's something, you know, that's not how, you know, that tradition works, you know. But you do get tempted sometime, you know. And that, you know, and from there, man, you know, I have been on, you know, quite a journey, you know, quite a journey, and through this program, man. You know, I've met a lot of people. You know, I've done a lot of meetings. I've been to a lot of conventions, and you know, I've had a sponsor. You know, I've worked the steps. You know, I believe in this program, man. You know, I felt, you know, the pain of people who have, new people who have come in. You know, and Bill was talking about, you know, the newcomers that come in and, you know, going over to a person at the end of the meeting and sharing. When I used to take my children to the meeting, one of the things that they used to bitch about the most, man, was that I was always, you know, available to be the last person to hug the last person that left. You know, there's something about that hug, man, you know, it's, you know, it's like an unspoken language. You know, Just for Today talks about language, the empathy, the unspoken language, you know. And, you know, I used to give those hugs to people, man. And as a result of my continuing to give, man, you know, I was getting, you know, our literature talks about attraction rather than promotion, you know. And what I wanted to do is set the example, you know, by showing up. You know, and by going to meetings, you know, I was doing a little research for the for this topic, and when I looked for the word example, the only thing that I could come up with that had the word example with, would you know it? The sponsorship IP. Mm. Yeah. We believe that the basic purpose of sponsorship is to help the addict through the 12 steps of recovery. It becomes increasingly obvious to us that the best way to do this is by example. Sponsorship is an extension of our own personal recovery, program of recovery. And, you know, up until a few years ago, I had a couple of guys that I was sponsoring, man. And it seemed that, you know, my God knew exactly what I needed, you know. Because once Junior died, man, he started sending me people, you know, so that I could be of service to him, you know. You know, we don't have leaders in here. We have people who are trusted servants. We don't have, you know, we don't have a board of governors in Narcotics Anonymous, you know. We have secretaries and chairpersons and treasurers. And what I've come to find out and recognize, man, that, you know, I'm really not in charge when I'm in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, that my time is important to me. You know, but we're all on the equal plane, and when I don't do that, when I kind of get outside of myself, when I start to think that I am the message and not the messenger, that's when I kind of get in trouble. You know, I realize, man, that I, you know, that time can be an enemy to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I can believe, man, that that start to believe my own shit doesn't stink. You know, I can believe. I had an experience with a bunch of my guys that I sponsor. We have a sponsorship meeting on the first Wednesday of the month. And one time we opened the meeting with a silent prayer. And I said, well, this, you know, and there's a group in Washington and in the Rock Creek area that does a silent prayer at the end of the meeting. And what I did at that sponsorship meeting was I said, well, let's end the meeting with a silent prayer. You know, and I kind of made a joke and made fun of it. And the reality, and I knew this, was that, you know, I wasn't comfortable with silent prayer. And what I really was doing, I was making fun of my sponsees that go to that meeting. And what I had to do, man, once I recognized that, you know, and this is talking about amends, you know, I had to call them back and tell them, man, that, you know, and make the amends for what I had done. And they told me, I said, oh, man, it's no big deal. I, you know, we didn't even know. Yeah, but you didn't know, but I knew.
Right.
You know, that was what was important. What was important is that I know. See, I can't be of service to people, man, you know, if I'm living with dishonesty. I can't be of service to people if I'm not working a personal program of recovery. And it's been a challenge. You know, it's been a challenge. It's been a challenge to kind of get up and get out of my house and just, you know, and get on my way with all these tragedies going on, man. It's been really hard. I've had to fight through a lot of sadness. You know, I've had to seek some professional outside help to help me deal with it. It hasn't just been you know, I've come into meetings, you know, I've sat down and you've hugged me, and that has helped. That has helped, man. But it has been a major challenge and a major obstacle for me to break through in Narcotics Anonymous, man. And so what I've come to understand, man, is that for real, I'm not in charge. You know, God's in charge. You know, he's kind of blessed me with a lot of things here recently. I'm a twin, just around this in February of this year, you know, I had two grandchildren. You know, in November of this year, November the 11th, my niece had a nephew, and she named him after my son. And his birthday is 11/11, and my son's birthday is 11/17. And for all you numbers players, you guys know that ones and those sevens go together. and what I'm seeing, man, is how, you know, God is saying that, you know, Alvin, you know, this is what I'm doing for you. You know, yeah, I know it hurts, you know, but just hold on, you know. Yeah, just hold on, you know. We had a ceremony for him. On his birthday, you know, I went down there where the people stabbed him. Let me clear this up. My son was an addict. Okay. He was an addict. Yeah. I got some of the medical records after he had been killed. And he was in a hospital on July the 30th, and somebody had stabbed him. And he told me he had been in an accident. You know, he had hurt his leg, and then he told me he had been in a car accident, and he had hurt himself, so he needed the medical information and all that stuff. He wasn't living at my house, you know. And when I found out, man, he had coke and heroin and marijuana all in his system. They had, you know, toxicology reports when he was in the hospital. And he came home about 3 days later, and you know, I came by his house, and I got him, you know, I went to get his medication. And I told him that Sunday, I said, Junior, man, why don't you just stay home tonight? I said, you don't have to go outside, man, you know. And that was like 3 o'clock Sunday, and they stabbed him and killed him that night. And for a long time, man, I kept asking myself, well, maybe, man, if I had just said something different, yeah, maybe if I'd have just kind of, maybe if I'd have blocked the door, you know, insanity, you know, my thinking. I just wanted so much, man, to blame myself for what had happened to him. And when I came in here, man, people told me, man, from the beginning, man, it just wasn't your fault, man. You know, it wasn't your fault. You know, and I remember, man, you know, all the days that I would go by his house, because it took me a long time to surrender him to his disease. You know, a lot of prayer, you know, a lot of coming in meetings and sharing with people, a lot of people helping me understand the part that I could help him with. And I remember having keys to his apartment, man, and every time I put the key in the door to go in his apartment, man, I had to pray. And it was almost like having a front row seat to a train wreck, man. So our literature talks about we are people in the grip of a continuing and progressive illness whose ends are always the same, jails, institutions, and death. It doesn't say, well, maybe, you know, you'll be able to escape with jails, institutions, death, and college. It says jails, institutions, and death. You know, and he was in the grip. And there was nothing I could do, man. You're talking about, my brother has 18 years clean, and I had 17 years clean. We're talking about 35 years of recovery, man. You're talking about, you know, a household, man. That Junior has been in my household since he was, four years old, I have been clean. And there was nothing I could do to stop his journey. And that's what folks were telling me. They said, man, he's got his journey, and no matter what you do, until he decides, okay, then he is going to have to make that decision. We had a memorial service for Junior. We had two. I'm going to tell you about both of them. The first one we had was down at the site where people had killed him, right? And you know, it was a candlelight and ceremony. And you know, a lot of people showed up. And afterwards, man, I went home and I was very sad. And I sat down on the side of the bed, man, to keep my appointment, you know. And I heard a guy say that. He says that, you know, the 11th step to him, prayer and meditation, is keeping the appointment with God. He said that God, you know, so now God is, you know, and what he shared, man, he said that God will always be there. Will you? You know, and so I went through the process of keeping the appointment, man. And what happened, man, for about a minute, man, I had the most satisfying feeling and emotion I had had since his death. And it took me a minute to kind of figure out, okay, well, what is this? And it kind of came to me, like Bill said, you know, you get those little moments, those aha moments. And what it was, man, it was acceptance. And what my higher power was showing me is like, man, I don't know when you'll get to the other side, but this is what it'll feel like. You know? See, I don't, you know. And so through that moment, man, I was like, thank you, God. You know, thank you for that moment. And let me know that I won't have to sit through this pain forever. You know, I was telling you about Bruce's spreading of his ashes, and we spread Junior's ashes down at Rock Creek Park. Okay, and my brother was there, and Junior's stepfather is a man who has a spiritual base, and one of the things that he wanted to do, he wanted to build a little boat. You know, some of us old guys know them old Viking moves. You kind of put your stuff in a boat and fed slowly. And floated down the river, right? And he made a little boat, waterproofed it, and he put different things in there. He put food in there, and he put money in there, and, you know, just kind of floating it down the river. And everybody was to put something in it. And my wife put a lock of her hair in there because, you know, Junior used to always be walking around. Now these young boys nowadays always walking around twisting their heads. Right? And my brother put a redskin pin in there for all you haters. Junior was a redskin. I see the cowboy man back there. All you haters, and he put a redskin pin in there, and. I put the our white key tag in there. Yeah. Because I believe, man, I said, if he had made a decision to take that, take that key tag and surrender, man, he would be here today. My journey, man, through the grieving process, I know they had a grief and recovery workshop earlier. But that journey, man, I don't get through that, man, without the people in these rooms, And that's why I said that, I really have not led by example, man. I have just followed and allowed you people to carry me, through that. I'm grateful to Narcotics Anonymous, for giving me what I have today. When I found out about his death, man, I was on the same street that I found out that same Q Street that I tried to snatch that woman's purse. Ain't that something, man? Albert, we had been looking for Junior for 2 weeks. We thought maybe he had, gotten angry with his mother because his mother was living, had moved in. And, he said he didn't want to stay there. So we thought maybe he was, went to a hotel or something. And somebody had called and said that somebody had killed him. And I called the morgue and I called violent crime. Somehow or another, I got the dates wrong. Right. So I'm thinking he had been killed on the 11th. And actually, he had been killed August the 4th. So he was a John Doe. I used to tell him all the time, I said, man, look, at least keep some identification on you, man, so we can find out who you are if something happened, he ain't listen, so when I found out, man, what had happened, it was about 12 o'clock, man, on a Saturday, August the 16th, and my brother had gotten the information, he had confirmed it, and I tell you, man, at that moment, man, I really, really understand what they're talking, the real true meaning of powerlessness. Because there is nothing that I wouldn't have given, man, to have him back. Nothing, no matter what I would have had, man. And now I understand that. And I want to share this with you, man, before I close, hopefully I got to lead by example, but this is what my heart was on my heart, man. It's been on my heart all day. And the thing that I'd like to share, man, because I know there are some of you out here, man, that have a Junior in your life. It might be your brother or your husband and, your son, your daughter. There's a Junior in your life, man. And what helped me transition from his death to where I'm at now, man, is at some point in time, man, I had to let him go. I have been praying for the last 2 or 3 years up to his death, asking God to remove the fear and the worry off of my heart. So when something happened, I would be able to live and move on, man. It's been a painful journey, man, but it's been an opportunity to grow. The sponsees, the grandchildren, all of that, man, has been an opportunity for me to grow, to appreciate my own personal recovery. And this may sound a little harsh, but I'm going to say it anyway. If Junior, God shared in a workshop on surrender, He said, if you don't surrender, man, somebody else will tell your story. You know, see, I'm here telling Junior's story, man. Because he didn't surrender, you know. And it's as painful as it is, man, you know, I have to be careful on my own personal recovery. You know, my son is dead, man. Anything I do, man, that jeopardizes my recovery, it's on me. It ain't about Junior, you know. Now, I just want to thank all the people. I mean, you really find the love and the support in this program, man, when you have a crisis like that in your life, man. Every hug. Sometimes people say the most outrageous things, you know, at a time when you're in grief. And what I recognize, man, is that really they don't mean any harm. They just don't know no better. They just don't know no better. And I'm not trying to beat them up, so I'll harm them and have some amends. But a loving hug, man. A loving hug, man. Even when they said things that, you know, I didn't agree with, once they give me that loving hug, man, you know, everything works out all right. You know, the title of this workshop is Lost Dreams Awaken, man. And, you know, I've gotten a lot of things, man. I had a new car, a house. I'm getting ready to buy some rental property. I'm getting ready to go to a spa in Arizona and going to visit the grandchildren in Hawaii. You know, I'm getting a lot of stuff, man. You know what I mean? But to me, that's not the real freedom. That's not the lost dreams awakened, you know. The ability to stand up here, man, and tell this room, man, that I have been praying and crying all day, man. That's real freedom for me, you know. That's all I ever wanted, man, to kind of, you know, the ability to express what was going on inside me, man, without having to think that I, you know, to be silly or overly sensitive or, you know, that was too intimate, man. That's the real freedom for me. And I thank Narcotics Anonymous for helping me get that, man. I thank y'all for letting me share.
My name is Tanya, and I'm an addict. I'd like to thank you both for sharing. Let's close this